Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, the results of our crowdsourcing or group journalism project, Are You Being Gouged? Over the last few weeks, we asked you to go to a grocery store near you and check the prices for three common items: whole milk, iceberg lettuce, and a six-pack of Budweiser. We were looking for price disparities and what they mean, and more than 350 of you took part. Thank you. That was great. We released preliminary results about 10 days ago, some of you heard, and here are the final results. And with me first is our associate producer, Jim Colgan, who I've been calling our crowdsourcing creative director. Hiya, Jim.
Hi, Brian.
So first tell me the highs and the lows for each product.
Okay, so the most expensive price for milk was $2.49, and that was in a place called Hans Deli at Broadway and Bleecker Street.
And we confirmed that.
And this is the confirmed price, yep. And the second most expensive, just to put it in context, was $2.42, and that was for a quart of milk.
Seatown at 8th Avenue and 45th Street in Sunset Park.
That's right.
All right, and the least expensive for milk?
The least expensive for milk was at Fairway in Red Hook, and that was at $1.09. And it was also, they share that with a fine fare in Gravesend, Brooklyn, also at $1.09.
So the disparity that we have, the range, is a more than 100% difference. The milk is more than twice as much at the most expensive store than the least expensive store.
That's right, among the prices we could confirm, yep.
Lettuce.
So lettuce, the most expensive was $2.49. And that was at a food emporium in Union Square. And then the next one after that was also the same price in another food emporium on Broadway in the Upper West Side. Then the least expensive was 88 cents for the confirmed lettuce, and that was in Glen Rock, New Jersey. And then there were actually a couple that were 99 cents, and there was a Garden of Eden at Broadway and West 107th that was that, and also a Whole Foods in Union Square was 99 cents.
And that leaves us, and we'll get back to one of the interesting points of that, which is that you found both a most expensive and a least expensive head of lettuce in the same neighborhood, which is the Upper West Side. And what about the item you could only buy if you were over 18?
That was the six-pack of Budweiser. And again, you didn't have to buy it. You just had to check the price. The most expensive that we could confirm was $12.99, and that was in Brooklyn Heights at a Garden of Eden there. The least expensive was at a fine fare, and that was in the Lower East Side, and that was at $4.99.
And that's the biggest range, I guess, right? That the disparity in the price of beer is the biggest among the three items.
That's right. And if you look, I think what's interesting to do is to compare them with the averages. We averaged all the reports, all the reported figures that we got, and the average price for milk was $1.39 out of all the reports we got. And so compare that with what the most expensive was, $2.49 for milk. The average price for beer was $6.63. So compare that with the most expensive, almost $13, and the least expensive, $4.99. And then the average price for lettuce was $1.79. That's for iceberg lettuce.
Now, I understand there's actually a state law governing the price of milk. So what is that, and how did it relate to the prices our listeners reported, which, again, was, you know, was in quite a range from $1.09 to $2.42 for a quart.
That's right. And, you know, it's something that people don't seem to know that much about. Even some policy experts we spoke to didn't know all that much about what the New York State law was. But I actually was on the phone with someone from the State Department of Agriculture this morning. And there is actually a guideline threshold that the New York State law, the Department of Agriculture, sets, and that threshold is $1.20 for a paper quart, as they describe it. So that's what they say. Anything above that is outside of their guidelines.
We're going to bring in David Leonhardt here in a couple of minutes, who's a New York Times economics correspondent who has written before about price disparities and what they mean. But we did also invite the 357 of you who posted prices to post a comment along with the prices. And Jim, some of these were pretty interesting. I'll read a couple. Maybe you want to read a couple from the ones that we marked. One person in the East Village wrote, "It makes me sad that I chose to give my business to a small family-owned bodega, and they are gouging." Someone else up in Washington Heights said, I would have thought or hoped that food would be less expensive in a grocery store in a poor neighborhood. Someone else in Melville on the island said, it made me realize how fortunate I am to like drinking milk instead of beer.
And then someone who was from Darien, Connecticut said, I might as well be living in New York with these prices. So, and which also there were a few entries that we got from other countries, which we didn't include in the final tally, the averages and that, because there was, you know, a different currency for one. So the one was from Copenhagen in Denmark. One was from Clontarf in Dublin, Ireland. And another one was from, and then there were some that were far outside New York, Fredericksburg in Texas, Columbus, Ohio, we mentioned. And someone actually posted from JFK Airport. So the price is there.
And somebody even posted from Shea Stadium. And when you get the equivalent amount of beer to a six pack of 12 ounce bottles, I don't even want to know.
No. And, you know, we should say that all these are mapped on our website right now in this really cool map. That our web department created, and you can click on those and see the prices and see where they are.
At WNYC.org. So, folks, we're going to open up the phones, and we're going to talk in a minute to David Leonhardt, New York Times economics correspondent, about price disparities and what they actually mean. And we want to hear from those of you who actually went out and did it. What was your experience like? Were you surprised? Did taking part change the way you looked at the price of these or any other goods, or about the issue of price or price disparity for basic items? Give us a call if you took part. I think it'll be interesting for everyone else to hear from some of the people who took part in this. And this will also help set up our next crowdsourcing or group journalism project. Call us, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, if you took part in this. And we'll talk to David Leonhardt with your calls in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're talking about the results of our crowdsourcing or group journalism project, Are You Being Gouged? More than 350 of you check the prices for whole milk, iceberg lettuce, and Budweiser at your local grocery store and posted them on our website. And we found quite a disparity, if you're just tuning in, between $1.09 and $2.49 for a head of iceberg lettuce, for example. So let's talk about what some of these numbers might mean. Our crowdsourcing producer, Jim Colgan, is with us. I call him our crowdsourcing creative director, and also now New York Times economics correspondent David Leonhardt, who has written about price disparities before. Hiya, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
So we've been talking about the different prices in different stores throughout the area, but these are very basic products. Can basic economics explain how wide-ranging the prices are?
Absolutely. I mean, on the most basic level, what you can say is that stores charge the prices they can get away with charging. Because if they charge a price that people won't then buy, that people won't then pay, then they're going to go out of business. And so to a large extent, what stores are charging is the most that they think they can get away with.
So let me ask you about this by neighborhood. The highest price that our listeners reported for beer that we could verify was in Brooklyn Heights. And the least expensive for the same product was on the Lower East Side. Now, you could probably say there's an affluent population in both places these days. So it seems like it's something other than the average wealth of the resident in play, yes?
Yes, I think it is, although I think that probably plays a role. I mean, if you look at the two on your most expensive list, and this is just, it's great data. The Garden of Eden on Montague Street in Brooklyn charges $12.99 for a six-pack of Budweiser, according to your listeners' research.
Uh-huh.
And I assume the reason they can get away with that is there are a lot of people in Brooklyn Heights who care much more about convenience than they do about price. They hop into that Garden of Eden, which is a pretty nice store, and they decide they really need to leave with a six-pack of beer, even if it's going to cost them a lot. They're heading over to a friend's house for a dinner party, and they're not going to let a few dollars dissuade them. So they can get away with charging $13 for a six-pack of not very good beer, in my opinion.
So now you're a beer critic.
Yes, exactly.
Jim, did you break out numbers by convenience store versus supermarkets?
Not per se so much. It was kind of hard to do that. But if you look at the most expensive for each and see what that is. Like the most expensive, I mean, what would you call Garden of Eden? It's more of a high-end supermarket, right? You wouldn't call it a deli or a convenience store.
Yeah, I wouldn't really call it a convenience store.
Right, but the least expensive for beer was a Fine Fare, which is a supermarket. And the most expensive for milk was a Hans Deli. The least expensive was a Fairway. The least two actually were both supermarkets. So you can see it tends to break down that way, that the least expensive is the supermarket and the higher ones are the delis, or at least the high-end supermarkets.
Right. So one lesson that we didn't really need this experiment to learn, David, is that convenience stores are convenient and that's what you pay for.
Yes. And I think that a lot of New York supermarkets actually resemble convenience stores more than they resemble supermarkets in other parts of the country. They tend to be fairly cramped, and they tend to have pretty high prices. I mean, you alluded to this in your introduction, but last year my wife and I put together a list of about a dozen items. And we looked at the prices at Fresh Direct, Fairway, and Food Emporium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we looked at the Fairway.
All high-end.
All high-end, but Fairway is not high-end with prices. And our shopping list at Fairway was $32, and our shopping list at Food Emporium was $47. And I think the sort of broader lesson there is that a lot of New York supermarkets are just not very good deals. And the way to get good deals in New York is to seek out the places that are sprinkled out there that happen to have good deals, like the places your listeners found, and the places like Fairway that aren't everywhere but are now increasingly in different parts of the city, the places that basically you know you go there because they are better bargains than a typical cramped New York supermarket.
Now, we're inviting our listeners who participated to call in if you took part and want to talk about anything that you noticed or just what this experience was like for you of taking part in a group journalism project. We're taking your calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. That's our on-air number. We will never ask you to pledge during our membership drive while you're talking about content on the air. And Vincent in Clifton did it and has a thought that I think is related to what we were just talking about. Hi, Vincent. You're on the air.
Hi. It's actually Vinit.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's quite okay. Well, the thing is, I'm actually the child of immigrants from India. I was born and raised in America, but my family is of Indian heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, growing up, I remember grocery shopping was like an all-day affair because we would go to like three or four different stores for different things. And one of them was we would go to our Indian grocer, our ethnic food store, not only to get Indian spices and things like that, but also certain items that were just way cheaper in those stores than in the grocery store. I remember buying milk only from the Indian store, certain vegetables only from the Indian store. And now that I'm a little bit, you know, now that I'm older, I have my own family and we do our own grocery shopping, we don't seem to do that anymore, and there doesn't seem to be that price disparity anymore. So I'm wondering what that means.
David, that's interesting that the ethnic specialty store is coming closer in price to the other stores.
It really seems that way. I mean, definitely in terms of milk and other items like that. But it's funny because growing up, I thought everyone must do this. And it was only when I would speak to my sort of non-Indian friends that they would think it's really odd that it took us so long to do our grocery shopping.
Interesting. David Leonhardt, any thought about that?
I mean, ideally, over time, we'd see some of these disparities narrow because you'd have competition. And basically, the store that was selling beer for $13 a six-pack would essentially have to stop doing so because of the store a few blocks away that sells it for a lot less. But that doesn't really happen, and that doesn't really happen because as shoppers, we're actually not that good at getting all this exactly right. We tend to be fooled by lots of things. We're fooled by smaller packages that will sell us one for $3 instead of five for $10. We're fooled by the lighting in the store. We're fooled by the colors. And I don't mean fooled by we don't actually know what the numbers are, but we have a lot going on in our lives, and we don't spend the time to figure out exactly where the best bargain would be. And so a lot of these disparities, while they should narrow over time, probably will never go away completely.
Carol in Brooklyn Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Brian. I've enjoyed the whole process of taking part, and I actually live and work and shop in Brooklyn Heights,
mm-hmm.
and I reported on Key Food, which was very close to average. And I occasionally shop at Fairway, you know, which is less convenient because it's either usually a bus or a car. But I guess it's kind of, I think, a sad commentary that for such extreme convenience, people would buy beer at the Garden of Eden for $13 when Key Food is centrally located and equally convenient, and it's $5.99.
Right. Well, how much, Jim, you want to?
Well, I was going to say, I guess it gets to what you were saying, David, about the irrationality of that goes in, that's behind consumer choices, right? I mean, there's literally one right across the road, a place where you can get it cheaper, but that's obviously not the main factor that people are using to decide their purchases, right?
That's exactly right. And I mean, I think what some economists would say is that's okay. If what that person is deciding is that the beer is worth $6 to them and the not having to walk across the street is worth an additional $7, then it's fully within their rights to pay $13 for a six-pack of Budweiser.
And there's a policy question here, it seems to me, because it's often not cost-effective for supermarkets to open up in low-income areas because they're drawn to the more lucrative, affluent areas. But we also see supermarkets closing down on the places like the Upper West Side, you know, in place of things like either high-end supermarkets like the Garden of Eden or these high-end convenience stores. And, you know, we've talked about ways the government can encourage supermarkets to at least open up in low-income areas. So do you see policy ramifications from these findings?
I do see some. I mean, I would want to be a little bit careful there because clearly we want to make sure that we can get good supermarkets in all neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods and middle-income neighborhoods in addition to higher-income ones. In some ways, though, I wonder whether some other policy options might actually be better tools for dealing with this, because I worry that if the government got into the business of choosing exactly where to put supermarkets, I suspect it wouldn't be that good at it. I suspect the decisions would be made based on which city council member wanted to have jobs in his or her neighborhood and which one had the power to do so. So I tend to prefer solutions like a really good public transportation system that lets people get around and go to a different supermarket if theirs is gas. Them and things like the earned income tax credit, in which you basically try to alleviate poverty by supplementing the income of low-income workers rather than start to decide exactly where you're going to put supermarkets. Though clearly, if there are barriers to supermarkets going in and doing good business in a neighborhood, the government's got to figure out a way to get rid of those barriers.
But you know, the government has gotten involved, at least in New York State, in how they set the guideline price for milk, as we confirmed actually just this morning exactly what that price was. And they say that there's a threshold price of $1.20 that...
what does that mean? Does that mean a maximum price?
It means, yeah, maximum price, a ceiling.
For a quart of milk.
For a quart of milk, because $1.20, they say it's for a gallon, it's $4.54. But, so that's what, if there's a store, a retail store, according to what the press person from the Department of Agriculture told me, that's charging prices for a quart of milk higher than $1.20, which is like most of ours.
Yeah, most of the stores we found.
Yeah, then they are violating that law. And I asked about what the actual enforcement is. And they said what they do is it has to be initiated by the consumer. So if you shop at a store that charges more than $1.20, you can actually call the Department of Agriculture and complain, and then they will go and investigate and either tell the store to lower their prices to the guideline price or impose a fine, according to what they told me.
So there's the headline, I think. More than half the people who reported on a price of milk out of 357 people in our area, at least those in New York State, which was most of them, reported on illegally priced milk. David Leinhart, we're going to bring on another guest in just a sec here, Jay Rosen, to talk about the process of this pro-am or group journalism or crowdsourcing, which we'll continue to use, and we'll talk about some possible future projects. But do you want to give us a last thought on any of this in 15 seconds?
Yeah, and absolutely. I'll lead into your next guess, which is I think this is exactly the kind of things we should be using the Internet to do. I mean, to make information gathering and journalism much more of a collaborative and interactive process, I think it makes us so-called professionals better at it, and I think it makes people more interested in it. So I'm going to spend some time sorting through this even after we go off the air.
Thanks a lot, David. David
Leinhart,
New York Times Economics correspondent, Jay Rosen, the creator of the idea of crowdsourcing, or one of them at any rate. Coming up next, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're talking about the results of our crowdsourcing or group journalism project, Are You Being Gouged? More than 350 of you checked the prices for whole milk, iceberg lettuce, and Budweiser at your local grocery store and posted them on our website. We found quite a disparity, such as between $4.99 and $12.99 for that six-pack. That's not a product placement, by the way, that we're mentioning Budweiser. We just chose Budweiser because it's so common. It was easy to compare the price and know we were comparing Budweisers to Budweisers. And our crowdsourcing producer, Jim Colgan, is still with us, and also now one of the founders of the crowdsourcing movement, NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen. Hi, Jay. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
And for the uninitiated, do you want to tell our listeners very briefly what your original idea was for this thing known as crowdsourcing or new media journalism?
Well, it starts with an insight from Dan Gilmore, former technology reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, who realized, my readers know more than I do. So the original idea was simply, people know a lot of stuff, and they can know things if we ask them to investigate. And the Internet makes it possible for us to gather that knowledge. And so investigating what the potential of that is was the original idea.
We tried to make this as organic as possible. So after our last crowdsourcing project, which is our idea, where people counted the percentage of SUVs on their blocks, you remember that one?
Yes.
We then went to the audience and asked for people's suggestions for the next project, which was this, and we took it from there.
That's pretty cool. That's public radio.
And we also invited them the second time around, the listeners, to collaborate at an earlier stage as well, which is how actually we ended up with beer. We said, we've decided this now based on a suggestion from a listener. Now we need to pick the items. And a lot of people probably remember the call-in we had where we asked for suggestions of the items. And there was a critical mass of people who wanted us to pick beer. So that's why we picked it.
Beer is popular.
Yeah,
One of the things I like about this, Brian, is economists sometimes say, well, if people had perfect information, and this is an attempt to sort of give people more perfect information about prices, because it's very hard for us to know what should be the price when we don't have good information about other prices.
And I want to reveal something here, and Jim, you can chime in on this too, because we worked on this together. We had originally planned to announce the results of this project on Monday, but we encountered a problem with the numbers that actually raised some questions about this whole approach. We couldn't verify some of the most extreme reports, and a couple of the ones that we could verify didn't seem to be true. In other words, some of the people reporting the most expensive prices, we thought, well, they were so outlandish compared to what most of the other prices were that we wanted to just double check them. That's the pro-am journalism, as you call it. You know, they're the amateurs, we're the professionals. Our responsibility here was to check the prices that were the most extreme. And we decided, we discovered that some of them did not check out. Mm-hmm. So we decided to postpone our air date until today to give us time to check up on more prices and make sure that the results that we actually put on the air are ones that are real. And, of course, it's impossible for us to confirm all 357, but presumably a lot of the ones in the middle are right. But what is this experience, the fact that some people who took part in this group journalism project either posted incorrectly on purpose or by accident, say about the value of a listener-reported fact?
Are you saying people made mistakes? That's unbelievable.
It is. It never happens with professional
oh,
journalists,
no.
Of course.
No, I think that it's in exactly why we need pro-am journalism, because you do have to check, and listeners check up on you as well. So I think, you know, listeners checking Brian Lehrer and associates, Brian and Lehrer and his gang checking up on listeners
all the time, which, by the way, is why we have a corrections page on our website and
exactly.
Why we frequently air corrections that people draw our attention to.
And right. Why we often get a call as soon as we've said something that may not be 100% true, we find out pretty quickly from our listeners.
Exactly. So now you're doing the same thing back to them. It's mutuality in action.
Except the interesting thing about this was that it was very hard for us to verify as journalists. So that when we tried to call a supermarket to get the price to confirm what a listener had reported, they didn't want to talk to us. They didn't want to tell us the price over the phone. So it seemed in some ways to be a thing that could only be done with a crowd, with listeners doing it. So we actually had to go to some of these stores and check the prices ourselves, which obviously was a bit time consuming.
You might have gotten listeners to help you check up on other listeners. That's actually one way that this could work. Another thing, if you project forward and you do these things regularly, you may be able to develop reliable listeners who you know have reported accurately in the past, and that would enable you to know whether you should check something or not. So I think in the future we'll know more about how to make this system reliable.
You know, crowdsourcing or group journalism projects do rely on a community to provide information. Do you think the mainstream media organizations ever see building community as an important goal? It's one I talk about all the time, that we're into deep analysis of the news, honest debate, and community building. I mean, I don't see, you know, the mainstream commercial networks articulating community building as something that they do, although I see that MSNBC just announced this week that they're buying the community-driven news site Newsvine. So I wonder if you think that Web 2.0 community-building news sites like that can exist within an older commercial media culture.
I don't think there's a lot of interest in community building among news veterans. I think they see it as something that maybe the public relations department should be involved in. Most of them have not grasped the very profound connection between strong communities and an interest in news. And there's plenty of reasons for them to do so, but I think professionalization in journalism takes a toll. And one toll is that professional journalists are encouraged to just sort of see the people out there as receivers, passive and entitled to news, but really entitled to no more than that. And it's very hard for people who have been able to do that for 30, 20 years to suddenly switch. And the web is forcing them to switch, but some of them don't want to.
Jim?
And one criticism of this model, I guess, by people who have expressed fears about it, is that this is sort of outsourcing journalism in a way, that it might allow you to give it to the listener, to the viewer, to the reader, that would replace the job of a journalist. But that's not the full picture, right? I mean, it's
well, let me ask you, did this project take more or less time than a typical radio program with a few guests?
Guess which?
Tell our listeners.
It took a bit of time because we had this mass of data that we had to deal with and we had to analyze. And, you know, hopefully as we go forward, we'll find a quicker way to do that. But yes, it did.
And follow up on, I went to a store about a mile from my house to personally confirm one of the very high price reports, which, by the way, did not check out. So it took more staff time, certainly, than a typical segment. Let me get one more phone call in here before we run out of time. Richard in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Brian. It used to be that there were convenience stores on every block here. And because of higher real estate prices, that's not the case now. And I was at a poker game the other day in the neighborhood, and we needed a deck of cards. And we were able to run down the block to this one convenience store that's left, and of course they charge a high price. And the guy whose house where I was playing was saying that, you know, he used to go from one convenience store to the next to get what he needed because, he didn't want to be gouged, and some of the prices were pretty high. And now he says he's just perfectly happy to pay whatever they charge just to keep the guy in business because he's the only one left in the neighborhood.
Well, that is an indication that rent, I think, plays into a lot of the prices that we see here. Jim, a last word?
Yeah, just one important thing that we found from this is, aside from the results, the end results which we're presenting, and we're saying, you know, take it with a caveat. It's informative, not necessarily scientific. But one thing that comes out of it, where that doesn't come out of an actual report saying here are the prices or a regular survey, is that because listeners took part in it, because they participated, it changed their perspective. And we saw that in the comments, that people thought differently about how they see the world and how they see prices in their stores, which is, you know, I see that that's a success in its own right.
Jay Rosen from the NYU Journalism Department, whose work actually inspired a lot of the thinking that went into this project. Thank you very much for your work and for coming on with us.
Hey, thanks, Brian.
Our crowdsourcing creative director, Jim Colgan, thank you. And folks, here's my next crowdsourcing request to you. The next thing we want to do is a group investigative journalism project. So if you have any ideas, you can go to our website right now and start posting them. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. You'll see the comments page for the crowdsourcing segment. We want to know, when you think of one, what is an investigative journalism project? I'm thinking maybe something in the healthcare, health insurance realm that we can do together with many of you. Post it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.